Was Saboteurs by Dave Haas. And welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Dave is the featured guest this week, and he's here to talk about his new album, his fourth full-length LP, Kick. Dave can be described as Philadelphia's version of Bruce Springsteen. He talks a lot about how Bruce was a huge influence on him creatively and personally, both as a musician and as someone who grew up in the Northeast. But he's also got a bit of a punk edge. He recently played a little mini tour. He did two shows here in Toronto last week. He did two in Chicago and did two in New York. And he's just about to embark on an overseas tour to Europe, which he always enjoys doing. That track that you heard was Saboteurs. And once again, the album is called Kick. This album, according to Dave, basically started with the 2016 election and how it divided people to create an us versus them mentality. But he also says it's about people trying to survive. Which is why he felt it was important to write about things that were happening to the people who have to get up and go to work every day. Again, very much similar to Springsteen. His cohort on this album, and someone he calls his musical soulmate, is his brother, Tim Haas. And that first song, as I mentioned, was called Saboteurs, and it's one of the centerpieces to the album. Along with the song The Ditch, that you'll hear later, as well as the new single Fireflies, which he talks about as well. There was a lot of conflicting internal feelings between Dave and Tim that took place over FaceTime, voice notes, phone calls, that had a cross-country, I guess, songwriting relationship, if you will. And he also talks about one of his good friends and musical collaborators who passed recently, Scott Hutchison of Frightened Rabbit, who also had an impact on this album. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with Dave Haas. Dave Haas, hello.
Hey, hey.
How you doing? Welcome to Toronto.
Thanks, man. It's lovely to be here.
You were just in Chicago?
Yeah, we were in Chicago for two shows on Friday and Saturday.
And I noticed that in this little mini tour that you've got between here, Chicago, and Brooklyn, that all the shows are sold out. Mm-hmm. What's it like, you're from the States, what's it like coming to another country and knowing that you're going to be playing to as big of an audience as you are back home?
Well, the shows aren't as big. The Dakota Tavern's pretty small. So the idea was more that we could come into towns where we know we have a bit of an audience and play over the course of two nights. Now that we have four albums, we could play two different set lists. We could sort of deliver the record in pieces to people as it just came out, and just kind of nestle into towns that we love for a little more time than just like the sort of normal hit and run pace of a tour. It's great. I was psyched when the first one sold out really quickly, and then we were able to add a second one, so it's great. I mean, we love Toronto. We feel like it's part of the same country, just insofar as it's a like-minded place. You guys just sort of do things socially much better.
Well, you know, I suppose, you know, New York, Chicago, Philly, Toronto are sort of all geographically in a very similar area. Obviously, that helps with touring because it's a lot easier to get to. But musically, and do you find that there's a lot of similarities between here in Philly or here in New York?
I mean, there's a lot of the same reference points, and I think that just each one of those places is a giant cultural hub. So they have their own musical identity, but then they also have, there's so many people, and there's such a rich musical culture in each one of those towns that something like what we do, which is kind of born out of, originally sort of out of punk, but owes quite a bit of a debt to just traditional kind of rock and roll music. There's like an audience for it in places like this. In Europe, it's a similar thing almost everywhere. You don't have to worry about it being in a giant city to do well. You can kind of play anywhere in Germany and people are going to come out. But in North America, it seems to have just taken a longer time to kind of catch on in places like Cleveland or Cincinnati or, you know, even Florida or Texas or something like that. So we wanted to kick off the record with shows where we knew that we had a thing going. So that's kind of how this came about. And, you know, just sort of like rolling out the record slowly in places where it's exciting and then, you know, kind of get to everything else a little later.
And I know you've been doing two nights in a lot of places, and you sort of alluded to it earlier, how you can do a different set list. But just in terms of, you know, being a little more relaxed and getting to see parts of the city, what is having a two-night stay on tour versus just sort of in and out do for the mental mindset?
Well, it makes you in some ways work harder, because if you have one, if the first show's really great, then you got to beat it. Or if the first show's kind of tame or not exactly what you wanted, you get another shot at it. So you have that thing. But in terms of getting around, like, I mean, all these places are places we've come for many years, and there's a lot of friends, so you get more of a chance to visit, in theory. You know, for instance, like in Chicago, we went to see the Cubs play, which was really fun. You know, at this point, your friends all have kids and stuff, and so they're like, oh, I can't get a sitter the one night, but I can come the second night, or vice versa, you know.
Right.
So there's just a little bit more flexibility that way, and it's fun. I mean, I'm not as... When I used to roadie for bands, I worked for the Bouncing Souls for a couple of years, and they were, I think, my favorite point in their development as a band when I was with them was when they were doing two-night stands. So it was like, instead of playing the enormous place in Los Angeles, they'd play two shows at the Troubadour. I was like, this is great. You can leave the gear set up, you know, sound check. The second night is shorter, and you get different sets, and you're hanging out with your friends a lot more. So it was something I kind of pulled from that experience, and like, man, I would much prefer to be in the my favorite towns for two nights than trying to play like the giant or the next step up, because you never know how that's going to go.
In terms of performing, when you're in a space, you know, intimate like the Dakota Tavern, you know, against a place like Rogers or Scotiabank, for example, because the audience is that much closer to you, does that make it easier or harder?
Both, in some ways. Like, I mean, you have to kind of read the room. Last night was a Sunday. Game of Thrones was coming on at 9. We were playing at 7:45, which is like such an early thing. It was very, very mellow. And so there were points where I wasn't sure, like, do we need to crank this crowd up, or do we just surf the wave that they're giving us, which is a much more like chilled out kind of thing? You know, do we kind of play a little bit more laid back? And we just did our thing, you know, and it either worked for people or it didn't. I felt good about it. But yeah, I mean, I think I like having to read the room, and I like trying to connect with music. And I think one of the things that always would frustrate me or be boring about playing in a loud punk rock band night in, night out is like, you got to play on Tuesday and Wednesday somewhere. And when you do that and you're doing the same thing as you do on a Friday, like, people aren't in the same mindset on a Tuesday or a Sunday night that they are on a Thursday or Friday. And so I think embracing being like a quote unquote solo artist and playing with just my guitar for so many years, you'd be like, okay, I don't necessarily need to do what I did on Friday. Tonight it's Monday. And so being able to read that room and sort of now apply that to my band, I think is a fun challenge because it's something different. You're like, oh, wow, we just hit them real hard with a song second. And they didn't necessarily need that. Like, maybe we want to just ease in here, you know? It's just like any other sort of conversation you have socially, you know? It's like you want to be able to read the wave and try to ride the wave you're given instead of, like, try to manufacture the same wave every night, you know?
Speaking of social conversations, I read that that's kind of how this album kick-started, was a lot of conversations that you and your brother had after the election.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were writing songs regardless. So what I guess the way to apply what you read in my mind was that we had a ton of songs and we had to determine, well, what's going to make the album. And I think that's wherein we started to say, like, all right, well, which songs are going to go on here and which aren't. And I think that was based on conversations socially and politically and really just like, how do we live in the stranglehold on humanity that we're witnessing, you know, what do we do with this information? Because the last record, I had met my wife, moved to California, you know, and wanted to make a positive sort of statement that sort of had a little bit of that bittersweet thing about when you move away from home, and then the election happened. So I was just saying, like, okay, this is, things were not what I thought in the country that we hail from and in the Western world in general. And how do we maintain our humanity against the backdrop of what seems to be like a much more inhuman world than I thought we were living in? And so that's kind of how the record came together. We picked the songs that serve that end the most.
How would you describe your writing process?
Well, it's not that consistent in terms of the way it happens, except for the germ of the idea. It's usually like a melody will blow in, or the idea for a lyric will blow in, and you go like, oh, that's the kernel. I got to hold on to that. And I'll cultivate it either now because I have 30 minutes or an hour to like actually run it down, or I'll set it aside. Hopefully there's enough reference point on it that I can get back there and then churn out, you know, then you sort of apply the craft of it. So that's the only thing that's the same every time, but it can come at a baseball game. It can come with a walk down to the subway. It can come in the middle of an argument with, you know, with someone, you know, it's you can overhear something while you're eating breakfast. I mean, you just want to keep your antennae up for the various transmissions that the kind of ether is sending and grab onto the idea that way.
Keep your war paint on, but we cook here in the sun. Keep your war paint on. Hey, hey. Keep your war paint on while your husbands pretend that it'll be alright. The message fails to send when the rains don't. Levee breaks again. Keep your war paint on. Keep your war paint on. Hey, I know November broke your heart. Dice were loaded from the start. One promise for American girls. No mercy in a man.
the lead single off the album is The Ditch.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that track?
So that was a chorus that Tim came to me with. And was like, what do you think? I thought, oh my God, I love this. I love the lyric. I love the melody. And we sat down. He showed me how the chorus went. And then I pretty much said, okay, well then the pre-chorus could do this and the verse would go like this. And we had a structure. And then we turned a lot more on the lyric. And the lyric sort of turned a light on for the rest of the record. That idea of kicking against the current. Whether or not there is a shore you're kicking towards or not, that the act of staying alive is what keeps you human. And that kind of idea is what informed a lot of the rest of the record. So The Ditch was like really kind of a keystone on the record. That's why it's second and why it's the first single.
And then your latest one is Fireflies.
Right.
Where did that one come from?
Fireflies, the idea was... okay, so a lot of times nostalgia is used in songs and it's kind of like a dirty trick, you know? And it seems to work a lot and I get it, but I kind of was like, well, why don't we write a song about nostalgia? Why is it that people get nostalgic? Well, it's because there's uncertainty now, and there was, when you look back on something, there's some level of certainty. You know, you know what that feeling was. And so we sort of try to knit together an idea of why would you want to be nostalgic right now? And I think like it's never been more uncertain. We have no idea what's going to happen with the economy, what's going to happen with the environment. It's terrifying to turn the news on, and especially politically in America, you know, it's a mess. So I think wanting to go back to that point in time when you're young and everything seems like a big promise that will get kept, if you can go there with someone you care about for a few minutes and shut the rest of the noise out, you can have some kind of transcendent experience and kind of get out of the chaos and lean into the moment. And I think that's what we were trying to do with Fireflies.
Playing with a sibling or a family member can always, you know, it can be good or it can be bad. You know, we see like Oasis, they don't talk to each other, but then other people are really, really close. You've described your brother as your musical soulmate.
Yeah.
What makes this relationship work, both personally and creatively, for you?
Well, I think the similarities and the differences both serve the same end. We're similar in that we were raised by the same people in two different eras. He's 15 years younger than me. So we both went to church, you know, which has a huge influence on your musical thing. We were both raised with the Beatles and the Stones and the Who and all that stuff. And then I sort of fed Tim a ton of punk rock when he was a teenager. And so he had this like education that way, but didn't necessarily find it himself. I kind of was like, here's Alkaline Trio, here's The Clash, here's, you know, here's The Damned, etc. And, I think that because we're so far apart, he's got a much different take on music, which I don't think of as often, you know, the stuff that he kind of makes his touchstones, I wouldn't think of, and then I kind of approach it with this, like, older brother, you know, I've got to prove something thing that he doesn't necessarily approach it with. And the fact that we have that much distance between us, I think, works because we're not competitive. Like, we're not competing for the same girl, we're not competing for the same set of friends, you know, like, there's enough of it. Like, I think when you look at the Black Crowes or you look at Oasis, like, these guys are within 5 years of each other, I'm pretty sure. And so naturally you're going to be competitive. You grow up fighting for the same attention. And that's, we didn't have that. You know, Tim was like our baby brother that me and my sisters were like, oh, wow. You know, so it's a much different kind of scenario. It's very unique.
Do you find any, actually, when I talked to Billy Bragg, he sort of talked about this, but any correlation musically between the punk rock and punk music that you love and the gospel that you grew up surrounded by?
Well, I mean, I just think that what motivates people to sing often is you're trying to find a reprieve. You know, I think like that's what both of those things have in common. It's what folk music has in common with punk and gospel and all that other stuff. I think that you're singing your sorrow, so to speak. And I think that, yeah, that I think all of music, though, you're trying to get up above the muck. And it's the only real magic that I've found is to kind of get up into this much more transcendent spot where we can all kind of put aside what's different and come together on what's the same, and or you know, and it's that sort of magic that I think that both of those things embody.
Punk music is notorious for being, you know, very political. And I know a lot, you know, some of this record was at least informed by the current state of the world. How consciously or unconsciously, how much of, you know, the politics of what's going on, or just the, you know, the world around you, how much of that goes into to your art?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm a big Bruce Springsteen fan. He's been a guiding light for most of my songwriting career. And I think the thing that he said was, you know, he felt that there was a burden on him to sing the lives of the people that he came up with. And I think on a much smaller scale, I feel the same thing. You know, there's most of my friends that played music with me when I was a kid don't play music anymore. They do it just very limited, and it's not professional. They don't get to play in Toronto or Berlin or something. And so they look at it like, whoa, you get to do this. And so for me, I'm like, well, yeah, that's true, but I wouldn't have gotten to do this without doing it with them, you know? So I think, like, you know, you think about the people at home working jobs that they hate, they would kill to be able to do this. So for me, working people, that's where I come from, and that's what I want to at least reference. The only thing that I think is different for me than the approach with punk is, like, I don't necessarily want it to all be political. I want to figure out how human beings are interfacing with an inhuman system. But I want to maintain the humanity. The reason that you're willing to fall in love and able to fall in love is because you're human. That's not the reason you chase profit. And I think, like, that correlation is what I'm interested in. Is, like, you know, I don't pick up a guitar because I want to make money. I never did. But there is this push to be able to maintain what you do. And so that the place where those two things intersect, it's not necessarily about art and commerce. It's about humanity and commerce. And I think, like, that's the real difficult thing for everybody in sort of like a capitalist cutthroat society that we're sort of seeing come home to roost.
Yeah.
You know, we're going, oh my God, now we have the leader of America is completely devoid of humanity. He's only about money. That's not what the country was supposed to have been built on. That's not the ideals that everyone holds in common. Regular working people don't hold that in common. So what do you do? So that's that intersection is kind of what is intriguing to me.
But, you know, just on making money, how much do you think that the actual business of music and the business of being an artist has changed over, you know, the last decade or so?
It's not easy. It is the system that brought us here was a broken one, and the internet kind of put it out of commission. Honestly, man, I don't know. I like, that's sort of a question for people who study that stuff. I'm intrigued by it because it's, you know, I am a person making my living from music, but it's a modest living, and it's very, very difficult. I mean, there, you have to go tour, and the touring is one of those businesses like construction or starting a restaurant where it's a very high overhead. So I don't know. I mean, I think you have to chase it for a reason other than money, because there's not that much money in it. Even when there is some sold out shows or there are some records being sold, it's when it finally gets to the artist, it's still rigged against the artist.
I've got a sepia tone Polaroid of you from days gone by. You looked so good in shades, but I wish I could see your eyes. Shining bright, right back at me like you saw something in mine. Lighting up the August night like dizzy fireflies. If we saved $1,000 back then, we knew we would be fine. We'd sneak into the golf course back when all we had was time. We'd lie under the fireflies and drink a box of wine. Long before you wanted more, and this whole world lost its mind. This whole world lost its mind. Can you meet me there tonight? I don't want nothing but your hand in mine. Like when we were young and wild-eyed, we had nothing but plenty of time. Lit under the fireflies. If I could double up my salary next year, we might afford a house. I could work away my fingerprints, grind the teeth out of my mouth. You said if we can't find our hope, we'll end up living by our fear. But every day seems less okay, and it hasn't been our year. I'm older now, and all I know how is to work to see your face. Smiling proud, knowing we carved out some tiny little space. This clock just keeps on ticking, we can't seem to slow it down. Let's kick against the current, and I'll hold you if we drown. I'll hold you if we drown. Can you meet me there tonight? I don't want nothing but your hand in mine. Like when we were young and wild-eyed, we had nothing but plenty of time. Lit under the fireflies. Don't want nothing but your hand in mine. Like when we were young and wild-eyed, we had nothing but plenty of time. Meet me there tonight. Meet me there tonight. Right when we were young and wild-eyed, we had nothing but plenty of time. Lit under the fireflies. Lit under the fireflies. Lit under the fireflies.
Talking about how the politically in the States, it's an interesting time. He's divided humanity. And of course, being from Philly, that's one of the centers of Confederation. You guys, there's the Liberty Bell.
Yeah.
And a few other things. I'm just curious if how much of that was ingrained in you when you were growing up in Philly? Did that ever influence you in a certain way? You look back and it's like, yeah, maybe that's in my music or my writing at all.
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I think maybe Ben Franklin, he would be like he's like a major looming figure, just like Rocky or
yeah.
Joel Embiid now from the Sixers.
Ben Franklin and Rocky, right?
Yeah, right. And Joel Embiid from the Sixers. Or Gritty. I'm sure it's in there somewhere. You know, there's some level of pride that the Declaration of Independence sort of came out of the town. You know, there's an old city, you know, area, which is all cobblestone or has some cobblestone left and so on. But I never actually thought about it until you just asked that question. I'm sure it's in there somewhere. I think that there's probably it's much more about just being from the East Coast in general, where I think that's what people think of when they think of America. You think of New York and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. Now that I live in California, this is sort of like a whole other world. you know? It's like where people go towards the quote-unquote promised land. But it's not necessarily, I think, what people think of when they think of, like, the basis of American political thought, you know? So I don't know. I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'll have to think about that more.
See, like, I grew up on the West Coast, and now I'm, you know, living here.
Right? Yeah, okay.
So I can relate to that. And I'm curious, like, how do you think the two coasts, how similar or different are the two coasts, both, you know, creatively, musically? Where do you see that?
Well, I've been really intrigued by this because I've been in California now for 6 years. And so that's enough time to kind of get a feel for what's going on. I would say if you're leaving the East Coast, it's as different to move out west as it would be to England. Because the only common thing, really, is the fact that you speak English. And other than that, they're two totally different worlds. I mean, I think when you look at the way humans migrated, it makes sense. The truly crazy people kept going for the promise of gold. You know, lots of people left Europe or whatever and said, oh, well, Boston, that's an awful lot like England. We'll stay here. Or Toronto. Or Philadelphia. You know, similar weather. All right, this is cool. We're away from the Queen or whatever it was. But it took a certain kind of ambition and madness to go, no, I hear there's gold 3,000 more miles away from here. And so I think that when you see that a few generations later, and you're like, wow, my neighbor here in California is really peculiar, at least to my experience back on the East Coast, you're like, oh, maybe it's because his grandpa or his great-grandpa decided to get in a covered wagon and go out for the promise of gold. I don't know. It's just sort of my silly theory about what makes things, you know, so different in the same country. But I don't know. The West Coast is awesome. I mean, it's certainly got the weather beat. And nature is just, I mean, it's phenomenal. But, I mean, in the end, I'm an East Coaster at heart. That's my culture. That's what I did 34 years in, you know, based on the East Coast. You don't get that out of your blood. It's like being raised Christian. You know, you can get away from it, but not only so far. but no, I love it out there. It's just, it is certainly a different world.
Yeah.
I bet it's more similar to move from Philadelphia to Toronto than it is to move from Vancouver to Toronto.
Which is what I did.
Exactly, man. I mean, that's a big difference. The weather alone is like, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah, yeah. So. And I know after you're finished here, you go into Brooklyn and then you're off to Europe.
Yeah.
The touring in Europe can always be a challenge for any musician because not everyone speaks the same language as you.
Mm.
And it can be a lot. I mean, now it's easier because you've got streaming, for example, but it can always be more of a challenge for a musician to find a base and a following in Europe. What do you enjoy most about going overseas?
Well, oddly enough, that's where our music is probably received the most. Germany and the UK are right up there with America in terms of the U.S., you know, it's like, I think it's the U.S., U.K., and then Germany is the most streamed or the most records sold or whatever for me. So music being like sort of the universal language gets through the language barrier for sure. It's also just a much more cultured place than America. Like they just put a big emphasis on the arts. They appreciate you coming back. They don't get bored. And so you work even harder to maintain that. So I love touring in Europe. I can't wait. It's sort of the highlight of my year other than sort of playing through the East Coast. You know, the East Coast and then Europe is like always where I'm like, yeah. So we've been blessed enough to have an audience there and I'm looking forward to bringing this record to them and hope it clicks, you know.
It's interesting that you mentioned that's where you have a following because it strikes me that maybe it's because those three places you mentioned, U.S., England, and Germany, have the biggest punk communities.
You think so?
Well, I mean, you know, you had punk music in the States with the Ramones.
Right, then the Clash.
And then you've got the Clash, and they're, you know, sort of early 90s, there's a lot of punk-like stuff coming out of Germany.
Right.
So
that could be, yeah, I don't know. I guess I kind of attribute it to I think that there's this weird fascination with, I guess I just think about it, like, honestly, like, where does Bruce Springsteen do well? Because, like, in some, to some degree, we're, like, descendants from that thing. I mean, he had an enormous impact on me when I was a little kid, and he certainly was pulling from The Clash, and, you know, there's overlap with all that. So I think, like, well, if he does good on the East Coast and UK and Germany, that's probably where we'll do okay. I don't know, but maybe it is the punk thing to some degree. I really don't know. I don't know what that correlation is. Like, there's friends of mine that have had random success in Sweden or random success in Australia, and there's never, like, an exact reason as to why something clicks somewhere. Because, like, you know, I mean, I approach the show the same way in Cleveland as I do Dresden, right. You know, I'm just playing my songs and trying to play them as well as I can and in as a compelling way as possible, but it clicks more in Dresden than it does Cleveland. I don't know why. It's just a weird, you know, I don't know. It's just a weird magic.
What is it about, or what was it about Springsteen?
Well, I mean, I certainly think it was just a time. I mean, his biggest record came out when I was probably 6 or 7, you know, at my most impressionable. But in the end, you look at him and Tom Petty and so, you know, they were like looming large for me as a kid, and you look at their legacy of just being serving songs and singing the songs of regular people and making a whole life out of it without a whole lot of bullshit, you know, and without a whole lot of, like, and this is the part where the flames fly out of the stage. You know? They never kind of succumb to that. And I think that, you know, all my favorite songwriters seem to, for the most part, boil it back down to that. Brandi Carlile, Patti Griffin, they all kind of say, here's the song. This is, you know, and please meet me where the song is. So I think, like, they all share that in common. I mean, I love Flames, don't get me wrong. But in the end, that a lot of that has more to do with spectacle and entertainment. And for me, it does boil back down to songs.
How early on when you were listening to Springsteen did you actually start to pay attention lyrically? Because I think so often when people listen to music, they don't pay as close attention to the words. They're just...
Yeah, that came later, probably much closer to, you know, 20 or 21. I really started to be like, oh, and Billy Bragg was another big one. It was like, oh, okay, I see what's, like, Billy Bragg lyric. I you know, okay, I know what he's going for here. I can relate to this because now I'm in the workforce. You know, now I'm like, you know, ripping drywall off the walls for $10 an hour. I get what it feels like to be in the existential crisis. And I think, like, then the Billy Bragg lyrics made more sense, and then Nebraska made more sense, and then the lights start to turn on for these lyrical approaches. So I think, like, it was later than when I was a little kid. I, you know, when you're a little kid, you're like, I had as much reverence for Purple Rain as I did. And I mean, not to say that there's, Purple Rain's amazing, but I guess a better example would be, you know, like a Billy Ocean song, like whatever was on the radio. Yeah. I like this, you know. But I did sort of hew much closer to Bryan Adams and that kind of stuff when I was a little kid, and Dire Straits, than I did the pop stuff that I liked. But I don't think I became too much more aware of the lyrics until I was a teenager and listening to punk, and then made the connection later that, oh, all along, Springsteen was doing a similar thing lyrically. It just was a lot more clever and covert.
Would you say you have a favorite track off of Kick?
No, it keeps changing. I mean, because what's happening now is, like, we're playing them for people. And so when that happens, you see lights go on with the audience and people go, oh my God, Fireflies. You know, I thought of my dad or something, you know, like a grown man friend of mine, 35 years old. It's like, it made me cry the other night. Like, oh, really? That was a song about, like, making out. You know, yeah. Like under the, you know, being drunk on wine, but I guess when you imbue, when you work hard at the lyric, hopefully there is layers to it, and then people come to it and go, like, that's the one, or I love Civil Lies. They're like, okay, cool. I don't even sing that one. My brother sings that one. But so that adds a level of excitement to bring in the songs. Bearing Down is a big one that I thought might go unnoticed, and people are really noticing. So it just keeps moving around, and the dust will settle probably in about 8 or 9 months when we're writing the next record. Like, oh, wow, these are the ones that worked, and here's the ones that kind of maybe we thought had better legs than they do. Or, you know, you just never know. One of the songs we've only played once live, so it's kind of too early to tell.
It's funny, you know, because I was having this conversation with my sister because she's been on the CBC Top 20 for a while.
Oh, wow.
And, but the song that is on the charts was not the song that we were initially promoting. It was just one that the CBC found. And as an artist, do you get surprised sometimes by like, okay, I'm going to promote maybe this song, but then people gravitate towards this song and suddenly this has become the song that's lifting you and the album up?
Yeah, I think that that's a really weird, cool thing, because it kind of just goes to show you that nobody knows what they're talking about except for the audience. I mean, and I say that with all due respect, like, press, management, radio people, the label, and even the artists go like, I've got this song, Saboteurs. This is going to be the one. Or I've got this song, Uptown Funk. Whatever it is, you know, this is the one. And sometimes that's true. And by virtue of you pushing that one, people become very accustomed to that song. But there's always this other outlier where you're like, this happened to me on Devour. There's a song called Bricks. And a lot of times it's when you take everything down to a very quiet, deliberate, sad place. And, I mean, that happens to me all the time with my favorite artists. Frightened Rabbit. There's a song called Nitrous Gas. There's a song called Die Like a Rich Boy. These are all the quiet moments on an otherwise rock record that I was like, oh, my God. Or I'm on Fire, to go back to Springsteen. So when that happens, you're like, wow, that's cool. Like, I love when that happens, because it proves that the exchange between what you do and the audience receiving it is the most important part of the puzzle, not the machinations of the industry, because that stuff is insufferable.
You mentioned Frightened Rabbit. I just wanted to quickly touch on Scott. Mm-hmm. I know he was a friend of yours, and I know he influenced you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What was it about Scott that you wanted to honor?
Well, I mean, he's just a wonderful person. But to me, in terms of that, his style and level of songwriting, there's two things that he combined that are so difficult. And one is like a high intellect and a vulnerability. He could do both and remind you that while he was vulnerable and beat up, that he still was really smart. And I think that that made the smart stuff smarter and the sad stuff even sadder. And I think that, I mean, I just think as a lyricist, he's among the best. And he kept his temple clean in terms of the lyric. He didn't muck about with like, okay, I'm going to go for the lowest common denominator thing here and try to sell that. He always maintained a very high level of lyricism, and that's what I think, like, I would aspire to. That's the, you know, I think that he was one of the best in terms of lyric writing.
Well, the album is Kick. Mm-hmm. It is out now.
It is.
It has. Thanks so much.
Thanks, man. Cheers.
Cheers.
And once again, that was my conversation with rocker Dave Haas. His new album, Kick, was released on April 12th. That does it for me today. The two other songs you heard over the course of the interview, the first one was War Paint, and the second one was his new single, Fireflies. And we're going to take you out with one more song off the album Kick. This is his lead single, The Ditch. My thanks to Dave Haas for coming on the show today. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
I throw shaking home with me? Will you shake, 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 shake it home with me? Shake it home with me. Shake it home.